This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Later by Stephen King. Read by Seth Numrick.
Marsden's house came into view. It was like one of those Hollywood Hills mansions you see in the movies, big and jutting out over the drop. The side facing us was all glass. The house that heroin built. Liz sounded vicious. There was one more curve before we came to the paved yard in front of the house. Liz drove around it, and I saw a man in front of the double garage where Marsden's fancy cars were. I opened my mouth to say it must be Teddy, the gatekeeper, but then I saw his mouth was gone. And given the red hole where his mouth had been, he hadn't died a natural death. Like I said, this is a horror story. Later. I don't like to start with an apology. There's probably even a rule against it, like never ending a sentence with a preposition. But after reading over the 30 pages I've written so far, I feel like I have to. It's about a certain word I keep using. I learned a lot of four-letter words from my mother and used them from an early age, as you will find out, but this is one with five letters. The word is later, as in later on, and later I found out, and it was only later that I realized. I know, it's repetitive, but I had no choice because my story starts when I still believed in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy. Although, even at six, I had my doubts. I'm 22 now, which makes this later, right? I suppose when I'm in my 40s, always assuming I make it that far, I'll look back on what I thought I understood at 22 and realize there was a lot I didn't get at all. There's always a later. I know that now, at least until we die. Then I guess it's all before that. My name is Jamie Conklin, and once upon a time, I drew a Thanksgiving turkey that I thought was the absolute cat's ass. Later, and not much later, I found out it was more like the stuff that comes out of the cat's ass. Sometimes the truth really sucks. I think this is a horror story. Check it out. 1. I was coming home from school with my mother. She was holding my hand. In the other hand, I clutched my turkey, the ones we made in first grade the week before Thanksgiving. I was so proud of mine, I was practically shitting nickels. What you did, see, was put your hand on a piece of construction paper and then trace around it with a crayon. That made the tail and body. When it came to the head, you were on your own. I showed mine to Mom, and she's all, yeah, right, totally great, but I don't think she ever really saw it. She was probably thinking about one of the books she was trying to sell. Flogging the product, she called it. Mom was a literary agent, see? It used to be her brother, my Uncle Harry, but Mom took over his business a year before the time I'm telling you about. It's a long story, and kind of a bummer. I said, I used forest green because it's my favorite color. You knew that, right? We were almost to our building by then. It was only three blocks from my school. She's all, yeah. Also, you play or watch Barney and the Magic School Bus when we get home, kiddo. I've got like a zillion calls to make. So I go, yeah. Which earned me a poke and a grin. I loved it when I could make my mother grin, because even at six, I knew that she took the world very serious. Later on, I found out part of the reason was me. She thought she might be raising a crazy kid. The day I'm telling you about was the one when she decided for sure I wasn't crazy after all. Which must have been sort of a relief, and sort of not.
You don't talk to anybody about this, she said to me later that day. Except to me, and maybe not even me, kiddo, okay?
I said okay. When you're little and it's your mom, you say okay to everything. Unless she says it's bedtime, of course, or to finish your broccoli. We got to our building and the elevator was still broken. You could say things might have been different if it had been working, but I don't think so. I think that people who say life is all about the choices we make and the roads we go down are full of shit. Because check it, stairs or elevator, we still would have come out on the third floor. When the fickle finger of fate points at you, all roads lead to the same place. That's what I think. I may change my mind when I'm older, but I really don't think so.
Fuck this elevator, Mom said.
Then, you didn't hear that, kiddo.
Hear what?
I said, which got me another grin. Last grin for her that afternoon, I can tell you. I asked her if she wanted me to carry her bag, which had a manuscript in it, like always. That day, a big one, looked like a 500-pager. Mom always sat on a bench reading while she waited for me to get out of school, if the weather was nice.
She said, sweet offer, but what do I always tell you?
You have to tote your own burden in life, I said.
Correctamundo. Is it Regis Thomas? I asked. Yes, indeed. Good old Regis, who pays our rent.
Is it about Roanoke?
Do you even have to ask, Jamie?
Which made me snicker. Everything good old Regis wrote was about Roanoke. That was the burden he toted in life. We went up the stairs to the third floor, where there were two other apartments plus ours at the end of the hall. Ours was the fanciest one. Mr. and Mrs. Burkett were standing outside 3A, and I knew right away something was wrong because Mr. Burkett was smoking a cigarette, which I hadn't seen him do before and was illegal in our building anyway. His eyes were bloodshot, and his hair was all crazied up in gray spikes. I always called him Mr., but he was actually Professor Burkett and taught something smart at NYU. English and European literature, I later found out. Mrs. Burkett was dressed in a nightgown, and her feet were bare. That nightgown was pretty thin, and I could see most of her stuff right through it.
My mother said, Marty, what's wrong?
Before he could say anything back, I showed him my turkey, because he looked sad, and I wanted to cheer him up, but also because I was so proud of it.
Look, Mr. Burkett, I made a turkey. Look, Mrs. Burkett.
I held it up for her in front of my face because I didn't want her to think I was looking at her stuff. Mr. Burkett paid no attention. I don't think he even heard me.
Tia, I have some awful news. Mona died this morning.
My mother dropped her bag with the manuscript inside it between her feet and put her hand over her mouth.
Oh no, tell me that's not true.
He began to cry.
She got up in the night and said she wanted a drink of water. I went back to sleep and she was on the couch this morning with a comforter pulled up to her chin. And so I tiptoed to the kitchen and put on the coffee because I thought the pleasant smell would wake.
He really broke down then. Mom took him in her arms the way she did me when I hurt myself, even though Mr. Burkett was about 100. 74, I found out later. That was when Mrs. Burkett spoke to me. She was hard to hear, but not as hard as some of them because she was still pretty fresh. She said, Turkeys aren't green, James.
Well, mine is, I said.
My mother was still holding Mr. Burkett and kind of rocking him. They didn't hear her because they couldn't, and they didn't hear me because they were doing adult things. Comforting for Mom, blubbering for Mr. Burkett. Mr. Burkett said,
I called Dr. Allen, and he came and said she probably had a soak.
At least that's what I thought, he said. He was crying so much it was hard to tell.
He called the funeral parlor. They took her away. I don't know what I'll do without her.
Mrs. Burkett said, My husband is going to burn your mother's hair with his cigarette if he doesn't look out. And sure enough, he did. I could smell the singeing hair, a kind of beauty shop smell. Mom was too polite to say anything about it, but she made him let go of her, and then she took the cigarette from him and dropped it on the floor and stepped on it. I thought that was a grody thing to do, extreme litter bugging, but I didn't say anything. I got that it was a special situation. I also knew that talking to Mrs. Burkett anymore would freak him out. Mom, too. Even a little kid knows certain basic things if he's not soft in the attic. You said please, you said thank you, you didn't flap your weenie around in public or chew with your mouth open, and you didn't talk to dead folks when they were standing next to living folks who were just starting to miss them. I only want to say in my own defense that when I saw her, I didn't know she was dead. Later on, I got better at telling the difference, but back then I was just learning. It was her nightgown I could see through, not her. Dead people look just like living people, except they're always wearing the clothes they died in. Meanwhile, Mr. Burkett was rehashing the whole thing. He told my mother how he sat on the floor, beside the couch and held his wife's hand till that doctor guy came, and again till the mortician guy came to take her away.
"Conveyed her hence,"
was what he actually said, which I didn't understand until Mom explained it to me. And at first I thought he said beautician, maybe because of the smell when he burned Mom's hair. His crying had tapered off, but now it ramped up again.
"Her rings are gone," he said through his tears. "Both her wedding ring and her engagement ring, that big diamond. I looked on the night table by her side of the bed where she puts them when she rubs that awful-smelling arthritis cream into her hands. It does smell bad," Mrs. Burkett admitted. "Lanolin is basically sheep dip, but it really helps." I nodded to show I understood, but didn't say anything.
"And on the bathroom sink, because sometimes she leaves them there. I've looked everywhere."
"They'll turn up,"
my mother soothed. And now that her hair was safe, she took Mr. Burkett in her arms again.
"They'll turn up, Marty. Don't you worry about that."
"I miss her so much. I miss her already."
Mrs. Burkett flapped a hand in front of her face. "I give him 6 weeks before he's asking Dolores McGowan out to lunch." Mr. Burkett was blubbing, and my mother was doing her soothing thing like she did to me whenever I scraped my knee, or this one time when I tried to make her a cup of tea and slopped hot water on my hand. Lots of noise, in other words. So I took a chance, but kept my voice low.
"Where are your rings, Mrs. Burkett? Do you know?"
They have to tell you the truth when they're dead. I didn't know that at the age of 6. I just assumed all grown-ups told the truth, living or dead. Of course, back then I also believed Goldilocks was a real girl. Call me stupid if you want to. At least I didn't believe the three bears actually talked.
"Top shelf of the hall closet," she said. "Way in the back, behind the scrapbooks."
"Why there?" I asked, and my mother gave me a strange look. As far as she could see, I was talking to the empty doorway. Although, by then, she knew I wasn't quite the same as other kids. After a thing that happened in Central Park, not a nice thing, I'll get to it, I overheard her telling one of her editor friends on the phone that I was Faye. That scared the shit out of me because I thought she meant she was changing my name to Faye, which is a girl's name.
"I don't have the slightest idea," Mrs. Burkett said. "By then, I suppose I was having the stroke. My thoughts would have been drowning in blood."
Thoughts drowning in blood. I never forgot that. Mom asked Mr. Burkett if he wanted to come down to our apartment for a cup of tea or something stronger, but he said no, he was going to have another hunt for his wife's missing rings. She asked him if he would like us to bring him some Chinese takeout, which my mother was planning for dinner, and he said that would be good. Thank you, Tia. My mother said, "De nada," which she used almost as much as, "yeah, yeah, yeah," and "right, right, right." Then said we'd bring it to his apartment around 6, unless he wanted to eat with us in ours, which he was welcome to do. He said no, he'd like to eat in his place, but he would like us to eat with him. Except what he actually said was our place, like Mrs. Burkett was still alive, which she wasn't, even though she was there.
"By then you'll have found her rings," Mom said.
She took my hand.
"Come on, Jamie. We'll see Mr. Burkett later, but for now, let's leave him alone."
Mrs. Burkett said, "Turkeys aren't green, Jamie, and that doesn't look like a turkey anyway. It looks like a blob with fingers sticking out of it. You're no Rembrandt." Dead people have to tell the truth, which is okay when you want to know the answer to a question, but as I said, the truth can really suck. I started to be mad at her, but just then she started to cry, and I couldn't be. She turned to Mr. Burkett and said, "We'll make sure you don't miss the belt loop in the back of your pants now. Dolores McGowan, I should smile and kiss a pig." She kissed his cheek, or kissed at it. I couldn't really tell which.
"I loved you, Marty. Still do."
Mr. Burkett raised his hand and scratched the spot where her lips had touched him, as if he had an itch. I suppose that's what he thought it was. 2. So, yeah, I see dead people. As far as I can remember, I always have. But it's not like in that movie with Bruce Willis. It can be interesting, it can be scary sometimes, the Central Park dude. It can be a pain in the ass, but mostly it just is. Like being left-handed, or being able to play classical music when you're like 3 years old, or getting early onset Alzheimer's, which is what happened to Uncle Harry when he was only 42. At age 6, 42 seemed old to me, but even then I understood it's young to wind up not knowing who you are, or what the names of things are. For some reason, that's what always scared me the most when we went to see Uncle Harry. His thoughts didn't drown in blood from a busted brain vessel, but they drowned just the same. Mom and me trucked down to 3C, and Mom let us in, which took some time because there are three locks on the door. She said that's the price you pay for living in style. We had a 6-room apartment with a view of the avenue. Mom called it the Palace on Park. We had a cleaning woman who came in twice a week. Mom had a Range Rover in the parking garage on 2nd Avenue, and sometimes we went up to Uncle Harry's place in Spionk. Thanks to Regis Thomas and a few other writers, but mostly good old Regis, we were living high on the hog. It didn't last, a depressing development I will discuss all too soon. Looking back on it, I sometimes think my life was like a Dickens novel, only with swearing. Mom tossed her manuscript bag and purse on the sofa and sat down. The sofa made a farting noise that usually made us laugh, but not that day. "Jesus fuck," Mom said, then raised a hand in a stop gesture. I didn't hear it. Nope," I said. "Good. I need to have an electric shock collar or something that buzzes me every time I swear around you. Let it teach me." She stuck out her lower lip and blew back her bangs. "I've got another 200 pages of Regis's latest to read." "What's this one called?" I asked, knowing the title would have "Of Roanoke" in it. They always did. "Ghost Maiden of Roanoke," she said. "It's one of his better ones. Lots of kissing and hugging." I wrinkled my nose. "Sorry, kiddo, but the ladies love those pounding hearts and torrid thighs." She looked at the bag with Ghost Maiden of Roanoke inside, secured with the usual 6 or 8 rubber bands, one of which always snapped and made Mom give out some of her best swears, many of which I still use. "Now I feel like I don't want to do anything but have a glass of wine, maybe the whole bottle. Mona Burkett was a prize pain in the ass. He might actually be better off without her, but right now he's gutted. I hope to God he's got relatives, because I don't relish the idea of being comforter-in-chief." "She loved him too," I said. Mom gave me a strange look. "Yeah? You think?" "I know. She said something mean about my turkey, but then she cried and kissed him on the cheek." "You imagined that, James," she said, but half-heartedly. She knew better by then, I'm sure she did, but grown-ups have a tough time believing, and I'll tell you why. When they find out as kids that Santa Claus is a fake and Goldilocks isn't a real girl and the Easter Bunny is bullshit, just 3 examples, I could give more, it makes a complex and they stop believing anything they can't see for themselves. "Nope, didn't imagine it. She said I'd never be Rembrandt. Who is that?" "An artist," she said, and blew her bangs back again. I don't know why she didn't just cut them or wear her hair a different way, which she could because she was really pretty. "When we go down there to eat, don't you dare say anything to Mr. Burkett about what you think you saw." "I won't," I said. "But she was right. My turkey sucks." I felt bad about that. I guess it showed because she held out her arms. "Come here, kiddo." I came and hugged her. "Your turkey is beautiful. It's the most beautiful turkey I ever saw. I'm going to put it up on the refrigerator, and it will stay there forever." I hugged as tight as I could and put my face in the hollow of her shoulder so I could smell her perfume. "I love you, Mom." "I love you too, Jamie. A million bunches. Now, go play or watch TV. I need to roll some calls before ordering the Chinese." "Okay." I started for my room, then stopped. "She put her rings on the top shelf of the hall closet, behind some scrapbooks." My mother stared at me with her mouth open. "Why would she do that?" I asked her, and she said she didn't know. She said by then her thoughts were drowning in blood. "Oh my God," Mom whispered, and put her hand to her neck. "You should figure out a way to tell him when we have the Chinese, then he won't worry about it. Can I have General So's?"
Yes, she said. And brown rice, not white.
Right, 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 I said, and went to play with my Legos. I was making a robot. 3. The Burkitts' apartment was smaller than ours, but nice. After dinner, while we were having our fortune cookies, mine said, "A feather in the hand is better than a bird in the air," which makes no sense at all. Mom said, "Have you checked the closets, Marty? For her rings, I mean."
Why would she put her rings in a closet?
A sensible enough question.
Well, if she was having a stroke, she might not have been thinking too clearly.
We were eating at the little round table in the kitchen nook. Mrs. Burkitt was sitting on one of the stools at the counter and nodded vigorously when Mom said that.
"Maybe I'll check," Mr. Burkitt said. He sounded pretty vague. "Right now I'm too tired and upset."
"You check the bedroom closet when you get around to it," Mom said. "I'll check the one in the hall right now. A little stretching will do me good after all that sweet and sour pork."
Mrs. Burkitt said,
"Did she think that up all by herself? I didn't know she was that smart."
Already she was getting hard to hear. After a while, I wouldn't be able to hear her at all, just see her mouth moving like she was behind a thick pane of glass. Pretty soon after that, she'd be gone.
"My mom's plenty smart," I said.
"Never said she wasn't," Mr. Burkitt said. "But if she finds those rings in the front hall closet, I'll eat my hat."
Just then, my mother said,
"Bingo!"
and came in with the rings on the palm of one outstretched hand. The wedding ring was pretty ordinary, but the engagement ring was big as an eyeball, a real sparkler.
"Oh my God," Mr. Burkitt cried. "How in God's name?" "I prayed to St. Anthony," Mom said, but cast a quick glance my way, and a smile. "Tony, Tony, come around. Something's lost that must be found, and as you see, it worked."
I thought about asking Mr. Burkitt if he wanted salt and pepper on his hat, but didn't. It wasn't the right time to be funny, and besides, it's like my mother always says, nobody loves a smartass. 4. The funeral was 3 days later. It was my first one, and interesting, but not what you'd call fun. At least my mother didn't have to be comforter-in-chief. Mr. Burkitt had a sister and a brother to take care of that. They were old, but not as old as he was. Mr. Burkitt cried all the way through the service, and the sister kept handing him Kleenex. Her purse seemed to be full of them. I'm surprised she had room for anything else. That night, Mom and I had pizza from Domino's. She had wine, and I had Kool-Aid as a special treat for being good at the funeral. When we were down to the last piece of the pie, she asked me if I thought Mrs. Burkitt had been there.
"Yeah. She was sitting on the steps leading up to the place where the minister and her friends talked. The pulpit. Could you..."
She picked up the last slice, looked at it, then put it down and looked at me.
"Could you see through her?"
"Like a movie ghost, you mean?"
"Yes, I suppose that's what I mean."
"Nope. She was all there, but still in her nightgown. I was surprised to see her, because she died 3 days ago. They don't usually last that long."
"They just disappear,"
like she was trying to get it straight in her mind. I could tell she didn't like talking about it, but I was glad she was. It was a relief.
"Yeah. What was she doing, Jamie?"
"Just sitting there."
"Once or twice she looked at her coffin, but she mostly looked at him." "At Mr. Burkitt, Marty."
"Right.
She said something once, but I couldn't hear. Pretty soon after they die, their voices start to fade away, like turning down the music on the car radio. After a while, you can't hear them at all."
"And then they're gone."
"Yes,"
I said. There was a lump in my throat, so I drank the rest of my Kool-Aid to make it go away.
"Gone."
"Help me clean up," she said. "Then we can watch an episode of Torchwood if you want."
"Yeah, cool."
In my opinion, Torchwood wasn't really cool, but getting to stay up an hour after my usual bedtime was way cool.
"Fine, just as long as you understand we're not going to make a practice of it. But I need to tell you something first, and it's very serious, so I want you to pay attention. Close attention."
"Okay." She got down on one knee so our faces were more or less level and took hold of me by the shoulders, gently but firmly.
Never tell anyone about seeing dead people, James. Never.
They wouldn't believe me anyway. You never used to.
I believed something, she said, ever since that day in Central Park. Do you remember that?
She blew back her bangs.
Of course you do. How could you forget?
I remember. I only wished I didn't. She was still on her knee, looking into my eyes.
So here it is. People not believing is a good thing. But someday somebody might, and that might get the wrong kind of talk going or put you in actual danger.
Why?
There's an old saying that dead men tell no tales, Jamie, but they can talk to you, can't they?
Dead men and women.
You say they have to answer questions and give truthful answers,
as if dying is like a dose of sodium pentothal. I had no clue what that was, and she must have seen it on my face because she said to never mind that, but to remember what Mrs. Burkett had told me when I asked about her rings. So? I said. I liked being close to my mom, but I didn't like her looking at me in that intense way.
Those rings were valuable, especially the engagement ring. People die with secrets, Jamie, and there are always people who want to know those secrets. I don't mean to scare you, but sometimes a scare is the only lesson that works.
Like the man in Central Park was a lesson about being careful in traffic and always wearing your helmet when you were on your bike, I thought, but didn't say.
I won't talk about it, I said. Not ever, except to me, if you need to.
Okay.
Good. We have an understanding.
She got up, and we went in the living room and watched TV. When the show was over, I brushed my teeth and peed and washed my hands. Mom tucked me in and kissed me and said what she always said.
Sweet dreams, pleasant repose, all the bed and all the clothes.
Most nights, that was the last time I saw her until morning. I'd hear the clink of glass as she poured herself a second glass of wine, or a third. Then jazz turned way down low as she started reading some manuscript. Only, I guess Mom's must have an extra sense because that night she came back in and sat on my bed. Or maybe she just heard me crying, although I was trying my best to keep it on the down low. Because, as she also always said, it's better to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
What's wrong, Jamie?
She asked, brushing back my hair.
Are you thinking about the funeral? Or Mrs. Burkett being there? What would happen to me if you died, Mom? Would I have to go live in an orphanage home?
Because it sure as shit wouldn't be with Uncle Harry.
Of course not, Mom said, still brushing my hair. And it's what we call a moot point, Jamie, because I'm not going to die for a long time. I'm 35 years old, and that means I still have over half my life ahead of me. What if you get what Uncle Harry's got and have to live in that place with him?
The tears were streaming down my face. Having her struck my forehead made me feel better, but it also made me cry more, who knows why.
That place smells bad. It smells like pee. The chance of that happening is so teensy that if you put it next to an ant, the ant would look like Godzilla, she said.
That made me smile and feel better. Now that I'm older, I know she was either lying or misinformed, but the gene that triggers what Uncle Harry had, early onset Alzheimer's, swerved around her, thank God.
I'm not going to die, you're not going to die, and I think there's a good chance that this peculiar ability of yours will fade when you get older. So, are we good?
We're good.
No more tears, Jamie. Just sweet dreams and
pleasant repose. All the bed and all the clothes, I finished.
Yeah.
She kissed my forehead and left, leaving the door open a little bit, as she always did. I didn't want to tell her it wasn't the funeral that had made me cry, and it wasn't Mrs. Burkett either, because she wasn't scary. Most of them aren't. But the bicycle man in Central Park scared the shit out of me. He was gushy.
5.
We were on the 86th Street Traverse, heading for Wave Hill in the Bronx, where one of my preschool friends was having a big birthday party. "Talk about spoiling a kid rotten," Mom said. I had my present to give Lily in my lap. We went around a curve and saw a bunch of people standing in the street. The accident must have just happened. A man was lying half on the pavement and half on the sidewalk, with a twisted-up bicycle beside him. Someone had put a jacket over his top half. His bottom half was wearing black bike shorts with red stripes up the sides, and a knee brace, and sneakers with blood all over them. It was on his socks and legs, too. We could hear approaching sirens. Standing next to him was the same man in the same bike shorts and knee brace. He had white hair with blood in it. His face was caved in right down the middle, I think maybe from where he hit the curb. His nose was like in two pieces, and so was his mouth. Cars were stopping, and my mother said, "Close your eyes." It was the man lying on the ground she was looking at, of course. "He's dead." I started to cry. "That man is dead." We stopped. We had to, because of the other cars in front of us.
"No, he's not," Mom said. "He's asleep, that's all. It's what happens sometimes when someone gets banged hard. He'll be fine. Now close your eyes."
I didn't. The smashed-up man raised a hand and waved at me. They know when I see them. They always do.
"His face is in two pieces."
Mom looked again to be sure, saw the man was covered down to his waist, and said,
"Stop scaring yourself, Jamie. Just close your—"
"He's there," I pointed. My finger was trembling. Everything was trembling.
"Right there, standing next to himself."
That scared her. I could tell by the way her mouth got all tight. She laid on her horn with one hand. With the other, she pushed the button that rolled down her window and started waving at the cars ahead of her.
"Go," she shouted. "Move, stop staring at him. For Christ's sake, this isn't a fucking movie."
They did, except for the one right in front of her. That guy was leaning over and taking a picture with his phone. Mom pulled up and bumped his fender. He gave her the bird. My mother backed up and pulled into the other lane to go around. I wish I'd also given him the bird, but I was too freaked out. Mom barely missed a police car coming the other way and drove for the far side of the park as fast as she could. She was almost there when I unbuckled my seatbelt. Mom yelled at me not to do that, but I did it anyway and buzzed down my window and kneeled on the seat and leaned out and blew groceries all down the side of the car. I couldn't help it. When we got to the Central Park West side, Mom pulled over and wiped off my face with the sleeve of her blouse. She might have worn that blouse again, but if she did, I don't remember it.
"God, Jamie, you're white as a sheet." "I couldn't help it," I said. "I never saw anyone like that before. There were bones sticking right out of his nose.
Then I ralphed again, but managed to get most of that one on the street instead of on our car. Plus, there wasn't as much. She stroked my neck, ignoring someone, maybe the man who gave us the finger, who honked at us and drove around our car.
"Honey, that's just your imagination. He was covered up. Not the one on the ground, the one standing beside him. He waved at me."
She stared at me for a long time, seemed like she was going to say something, then just buckled my seatbelt.
"I think maybe we should skip the party. How does that sound to you?"
"Good," I said. "I don't like Lily anyway. She sneaky pinches me during story time." We went home. Mom asked me if I could keep down a cup of cocoa, and I said I could. We drank cocoa together in the living room. I still had Lily's present. It was a little doll in a sailor suit. When I gave it to Lily the next week, instead of sneaky pinching me, she gave me a kiss right on the mouth. I got teased about that and never minded a bit. While we were drinking our cocoa, she might have put a little something extra in hers, Mom said,
"I promised myself when I was pregnant that I'd never lie to my kid. So, here goes. Yeah, that guy was probably dead."
She paused.
"No, he was dead. I don't think even a bike helmet would have saved him, and I didn't see one."
"No, he wasn't wearing a helmet, because if he'd been wearing it when he got hit, it was a taxi that did it, we found out, he would have been wearing it as he stood beside his body. They're always wearing what they had on when they died.
But you only imagined you saw his face, honey. You couldn't have. Someone covered him up with a jacket, someone very kind.
He was wearing a t-shirt with a lighthouse on it, I said. Then I thought of something else. It was only a little bit cheery, but after something like that, I guess you take what you can get.
At least he was pretty old. Why do you say that?
She was looking at me oddly. Looking back on it, I think that was when she started to believe, at least a little bit.
His hair was white, except for the parts with blood in it, that is.
I started to cry again. My mother hugged me and rocked me, and I went to sleep while she was doing it. I tell you what, there's nothing like having a mother around when you're thinking of scary shit. We got the Times delivered to our door. My mother usually read it at the table in her bathrobe while we ate breakfast, but the day after the Central Park man, she was reading one of her manuscripts instead. When breakfast was over, she told me to get dressed and maybe we'd ride the Circle Line. So, must have been a Saturday. I remember thinking it was the first weekend the Central Park man was dead in. That made it real all over again. I did what she said, but first I went into her bedroom while she was in the shower. The newspaper was on the bed, open to the page where they put dead folks who are famous enough for the Times. The picture of the Central Park man was there. His name was Robert Harrison. At 4, I was already reading at a third grade level, my mother was very proud of that, and there were no tough words in the headline of the story, which was all I read. CEO of Lighthouse Foundation dies in traffic accident. I saw a few more dead people after that. The saying about how in life we are in death is truer than most people know, and sometimes I said something to Mom, but mostly I didn't, because I could see it upset her. It wasn't until Mrs. Burkett died and Mom found her rings in the closet that we really talked about it again. That night, after she left my room, I thought I wouldn't be able to sleep, and if I did, I would dream about the Central Park man with his split-open face and bones sticking out of his nose, or about my mother in her coffin, but also sitting on the steps to the pulpit, where only I could see her. But so far as I can remember, I didn't dream about anything. I got up the next morning feeling good, and Mom was feeling good, and we joked around like we sometimes did, and she stuck my turkey on the fridge and put a big smackaroo on it, which made me giggle, and she walked me to school, and Mrs. Tate told us about dinosaurs, and life went on for 2 years in the good ways it usually did, until, that is, everything fell apart. 6. When Mom realized how bad things were, I heard her talking to Ann Staley, her editor friend, about Uncle Harry on the phone. Mom said, "He was soft even before he went soft. I realize that now." At 6, I wouldn't have had a clue, but by then I was 8 going on 9, and I understood, at least partly. She was talking about the mess her brother had gotten himself and her into even before the early onset Alzheimer's carried off his brains like a thief in the night. I agreed with her, of course, she was my mother and it was us against the world, a team of two. I hated Uncle Harry for the jam we were in. It wasn't until later, when I was 12 or maybe even 14, that I realized my mother was also partly to blame. She might have been able to get out while there was still time, probably could have, but she didn't. Like Uncle Harry, who founded the Conklin Literary Agency, she knew a lot about books, but not enough about money. She even got 2 warnings. One was from her friend Liz Dutton. Liz was an NYPD detective and a great fan of Regis Thomas's Roanoke series. Mom met her at a launch party for one of those books and they clicked, which turned out to be not so good. I'll get to it, but for now I'll just say that Liz told my mother that the McKenzie Fund was too good to be true. This might have been around the time Mrs. Burkett died, I'm not sure about that, but I know it was before the fall of 2008 when the economy went belly up, including our part of it. Uncle Harry used to play racquetball at some fancy club near Pier 90 where the big boats dock. One of the friends he played with was a Broadway producer who told him about the McKenzie Fund. The friend called it a license to coin money, and Uncle Harry took him seriously about that. Why wouldn't he? The friend had produced like a bazillion musicals that ran on Broadway for a bazillion years, plus all over the country, and the royalties just poured in. I knew exactly what royalties were. I was a literary agent's kid. Uncle Harry checked it out, talked to some big bug who worked for the fund, although not to James McKenzie himself, because Uncle Harry was just a small bug in the great scheme of things, and put in a bunch of money. The returns were so good that he put in more, and more. When he got the Alzheimer's, and he went downhill really fast, my mother took over all the accounts, and she not only stuck with the McKenzie Fund, she put even more money into it. Monty Grisham, the lawyer who helped with contracts back then, not only told her not to put in more, he told her to get out while the getting was good. That was the other warning she got, and not long after, she took over the Conklin Agency. He also said that if a thing looked too good to be true, it probably was. I'm telling you everything I found out in little driblets and drablets, like that overheard conversation between Mom and her editor pal. I'm sure you get that, and I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that the McKenzie Fund was actually a big fat Ponzi scheme. The way it worked was McKenzie and his merry band of thieves took in mega millions and paid back big percentage returns while skimming off most of the investment dough. They kept it going by roping in new investors, telling each one how special he or she was because only a select few were allowed into the fund. The select few, it turned out, were thousands. Everyone from Broadway producers to wealthy widows who stopped being wealthy almost overnight. A scheme like that depends on investors being happy with their returns and not only leaving their initial investments in the fund, but putting in more. It worked okay for a while, but when the economy crashed in 2008, almost everybody in the fund asked for their money back, and the money wasn't there. McKenzie was a piker compared to Madoff, the king of Ponzi schemes, but he gave old Byrne a run for his money. After taking in over $20 billion, all he had in the McKenzie accounts was a measly $15 million. He went to jail, which was satisfying, but as Mom sometimes said, grits ain't groceries and revenge don't pay the bills. "We're okay, we're okay," she told me when McKenzie started showing up on all the news channels and in the Times. "Don't worry, Jamie." But the circles under her eyes said that she was plenty worried, and she had plenty of reasons to be. Here's more of what I found out later. Mom only had about 200 grand in assets she could put her hands on, and that included the insurance policies on her and me. What she had on the liability side of the ledger, you don't want to know. Just remember, our apartment was on Park Avenue, the agency was on Madison Avenue, and the extended care home where Uncle Harry was living, if you can call that living, I can hear my mother adding, was in Pound Ridge, which is about as expensive as it sounds. Closing the office on Madison was Mom's first move. After that, she worked out of the palace on Park, at least for a while. She paid some rent in advance by cashing in those insurance policies I mentioned, including her brother's, but that would only last 8 or 10 months. She rented Uncle Harry's place in Speonk. She sold the Range Rover. "We don't really need a car in the city anyway, Jamie," she said, and a bunch of first edition books, including a signed Thomas Wolfe of Look Homeward Angel. She cried over that one and said she didn't get half of what it was worth because the rare book market was also in the toilet thanks to a bunch of sellers as desperate for cash as she was. Our Andrew Wyeth painting went too, and every day she cursed James McKenzie for the thieving, money-grubbing, motherfucking, cock-sucking, bleeding, hemorrhoid-on-legs that he was. Sometimes she also cursed Uncle Harry, saying he'd be living behind a garbage dumpster by the end of the year, and it would serve him right. And, to be fair, later on she cursed herself for not listening to Liz and Monty. "I feel like the grasshopper who played all summer instead of working," she said to me one night, January or February of 2009, I think. By then, Liz was staying over sometimes, but not that night. That might have been the first time I noticed there were threads of gray in my mom's pretty red hair. Or maybe I remember because she started to cry and it was my turn to comfort her, even though I was just a little kid and didn't really know how to do it. That summer, we moved out of the Palace on Park and into a much smaller place on 10th Avenue. "Not a dump," Mom said. "And the price is right." Also,
I'll be damned if I move out of the city. That would be waving the white flag. I'd start losing clients. The agency moved with us, of course. The office was in what I suppose would have been my bedroom if things hadn't been so fucking dire. My room was an alcove adjacent to the kitchen. It was hot in the summer and cold in the winter, but at least it smelled good. I think it used to be the pantry. She moved Uncle Harry to a facility in Bayonne. The less said about that place, the better. The only good thing about it, I suppose, was that poor Uncle Harry didn't know where he was anyway. He would have pissed his pants just as much if he'd been in the Beverly Hilton. Other things I remember about 2009 and 2010, my mother stopped getting her hair done. She stopped lunching with friends and only lunched with clients of the agency if she really had to, because she was the one who always got stuck with a check. She didn't buy many new clothes, and the ones she did buy were from discount stores. And she started drinking more wine. A lot more. There were nights when she and her friend Liz, the Regis Thomas fan and detective I told you about, would get pretty soused together. The next day, Mom would be red-eyed and snappy, puttering around in her office in her pajamas. Sometimes she'd sing, "Crappy days are here again, the skies are fucking drear again." On those days, it was a relief to go to school. A public school, of course. My private school days were over, thanks to James McKenzie. There were a few rays of light in all that gloom. The rare book market might have been in the shithouse, but people were reading regular books again, novels to escape and self-help books, because, let's face it, in 2009 and 10, a lot of people needed to help themselves. Mom was always a big mystery reader, and she'd been building up that part of the Conklin stable ever since taking over for Uncle Harry. She had 10 or maybe even a dozen mystery authors. They weren't big-ticket guys and gals, but their 15% brought in enough to pay the rent and keep the lights on in our new place. Plus, there was Jane Reynolds, a librarian from North Carolina. Her novel, a mystery titled Dead Red, came in over the transom, and Mom just raved about it. There was an auction for who would get to publish it. All the big companies took part, and the rights ended up selling for $2 million. 300,000 of those scoots were ours, and my mother began to smile again. "It will be a long time before we get back to Park Avenue," she said. "And we've got a lot of climbing to do before we get out of the hole Uncle Harry dug for us, but we just might make it." "I don't want to go back to Park Avenue anyway," I said. "I like it here." She smiled and hugged me. "Here, my little love." She held me at arm's length and studied me. "Not so little anymore either. Do you know what I'm hoping, kiddo?" I shook my head. "That Jane Reynolds turns out to be a book-a-year babe. And that the movie of Dead Red gets made. Even if neither of those things happen, there's good old Regis Thomas and his Roanoke saga. He's the jewel in our crown." Only Dead Red turned out to be like a final flash of sunlight before a big storm moves in. The movie never got made, and the publishers who bid on the book got it wrong, as they sometimes do. The book flopped, which didn't hurt us financially, the money was paid, but other stuff happened, and that 300 grand vanished like dust in the wind. First, Mom's wisdom teeth went to hell and got infected. She had to have them all pulled. That was bad. Then Uncle Harry, troublesome Uncle Harry, still not 50 years old, tripped in the Bayonne care facility and fractured his skull. That was a lot worse. Mom talked to the lawyer who helped her with book contracts and took a healthy bite of our agency fee for his trouble. He recommended another lawyer who specialized in liability and negligence suits. That lawyer said we had a good case, and maybe we did, but before the case got anywhere near a courtroom, the Bayonne facility declared bankruptcy. The only one who made money out of that was the fancy slip-and-fall lawyer, who banked just shy of $40,000. "Those billable hours are a bitch," Mom said one night when she and Liz Dutton were well into their second bottle of wine. Liz laughed because it wasn't her $40,000. Mom laughed because she was squiffed. I was the only one who didn't see the humor in it because it wasn't just the lawyer's bills. We were on the hook for Uncle Harry's medical bills as well. Worst of all, the IRS came after Mom for back taxes Uncle Harry owed. He had been putting off that other uncle, Sam, so he could dump more money into the McKenzie Fund, which left Regis Thomas, the jewel in our crown.
7. Now check this out. It's the fall of 2009, Obama is president, and the economy is slowly getting better. For us, not so much. I'm in the third grade, and Miss Pierce has me doing a fractions problem on the board, because I'm good at shit like that. I mean, I was doing percentages when I was 7. Literary agent's kid, remember? The kids behind me are restless because it's that funny little stretch of school between Thanksgiving and Christmas. The problem is as easy as soft butter on toast, and I'm just finishing when Mr. Hernandez, the assistant principal, sticks his head in. He and Miss Pierce have a brief, murmured conversation, and then Miss Pierce asks me to step out into the hall. My mother is waiting out there, and she's as pale as a glass of milk. Skim milk. My first thought is that Uncle Harry, who now has a steel plate in his skull to protect his useless brain, has died. Which, in a gruesome way, would actually be good because it would cut down on expenses. But when I ask, she says Uncle Harry, by then living in a third-rate care home in Piscataway, he kept moving further west like some fucked-up brain-dead pioneer, is fine. Mom hustles me down the hall and out the door before I can ask any more questions. Parked at the yellow curb where parents drop off their kids and pick them up in the afternoon is a Ford sedan with a bubble light on the dash. Standing beside it in a blue parka with NYPD on the breast is Liz Dutton. Mom is rushing me toward the car, but I dig in my heels and make her stop. "What is it?" I ask. "Tell me." I'm not crying, but the tears are close. There's been a lot of bad news since we found out about the McKenzie Fund, and I don't think I can stand any more, but I get some. Regis Thomas is dead. The jewel just fell out of our crown. 8. I have to stop here and tell you about Regis Thomas. My mother used to say that most writers are as weird as turds that glow in the dark, and Mr. Thomas was a case in point. The Roanoke Saga, that's what he called it, consisted of 9 books when he died, each one as thick as a brick. "Old Regis always serves up a heaping helping," Mom said once. When I was 8, I snitched a copy of the first one, Death Swamp of Roanoke, off one of the office shelves and read it. No problem there, I was as good at reading as I was at math and seeing dead folks. It's not bragging if it's true. Plus, Death Swamp wasn't exactly Finnegan's Wake. I'm not saying it was badly written, don't get that idea, the man could tell a tale. There was plenty of adventure, lots of scary scenes, especially in the Death Swamp. A search for buried treasure and a big, hot helping of good old S.E.X. I learned more about the true meaning of 69 in that book than a kid of 8 should probably know. I learned something else as well, although I only made a conscious connection later. It was about all those nights Mom's friend Liz stayed over. I'd say there was a sex scene every 50 pages or so in Death Swamp, including one in a tree while hungry alligators crawled around beneath. We're talking 50 shades of Roanoke. In my early teens, Regis Thomas taught me to jack off, and if that's too much information, deal with it. The books really were a saga in that they told one continuing story with a cast of continuing characters. They were strong men with fair hair and laughing eyes, untrustworthy men with shifty eyes, noble Indians, who in later books would become noble Native Americans, and gorgeous women with firm, high breasts. Everyone, the good, the bad, the firm-breasted, was Randy, all the time. The heart of the series, what kept the readers coming back, other than the duels, murders, and sex, that is, was the Titanic secret that had caused all the Roanoke settlers to disappear. Had it been the fault of George Threadgill, the chief villain? Were the settlers dead? Was there really an ancient city beneath Roanoke full of ancient wisdom? What did Martin Betancourt mean when he said, "Time is the key," before expiring? What did that cryptic word, Croatoan, found carved on a palisade of the abandoned community, really mean? Millions of readers slavered to know the answers to those questions. To anyone far in the future finding that hard to believe, I'd simply tell you to hunt up something by Judith Krantz or Harold Robbins. Millions of people read their stuff, too. Regis Thomas's characters were classic projection, or maybe I mean wish fulfillment. He was a little wizened dude whose author photo was routinely altered to make his face look a little less like a lady's leather purse. He didn't come to New York City because he couldn't. The guy who wrote about fearless men hacking their way through pestilent swamps, fighting duels, and having athletic sex under the stars was an agoraphobe bachelor who lived alone. He was also incredibly paranoid, so said my mother, about his work. No one saw it until it was done, and after the first two volumes were such rip-roaring successes, staying at the top of the bestseller lists for months, that included a copy editor. He insisted that they be published as he wrote them, word for golden word. He wasn't a book-a-year author, that literary agent's El Dorado, but he was dependable. A book with Of Roanoke in the title would appear every 2 or 3 years. The first four came during Uncle Harry's tenure, the next five in Mom's. That included Ghost Maiden of Roanoke, which Thomas announced was the penultimate volume. The last book in the series, he promised, would answer all the questions his loyal readers had been asking ever since those first expeditions into the Death Swamp.